south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's get to some emails. I got a big backlog here, so let's get at it. This one's from Derek. He says, Johnny, once in a while, you talk about writing the great un-American novel. You say there's a million and one places in Latin America that are so laid back and tranquil, ideal for such things. That's the impetus behind my Plan B move. Because, you see, in my case, I attempted to write the great American novel up in the States, and it didn't work out so well. Turns out I was one of those guys, when I hit my mid-30s, I made a lot of money the easy way. I inherited it. Me, Johnny, lucky stiff, huh? Then he says, I decided to take a year off of doing nothing. I went to my grandparents' cabin in Upper Michigan, and I attempted to write the great American novel. And 600 pages later, let me tell you, if you want to get kicked around and experience no end of frustrations, go ahead, try writing a book and try selling it. Writing is the easiest part, let me tell you. And for me, with an English major in college, I figured this should be a piece of cake. Besides, I can sit in a room for hours at a time. I can lay on a couch for hours at a time. I can watch TV for hours at a time. In fact, I'm one of those guys who considers laziness an asset. I think you really need it if you're going to sit around and try to write a book. All you have to do is, you know, think and type a bit. The problem is, you see, reading books is something of a lost art, especially real books that have weight and have pages. Because, you know, in today's ultra-PC world, tree huggers will call you an eco-Nazi for using too much real paper. So you got the fact that less people read books. Attention spans are lower. They weigh a lot, so people don't want to haul them around. Even Kindles are a pain. They're bulky. And as far as actually doing the work, 99% of people who write books have to have other day jobs to support themselves. Who else is going to pay for your living expenses for a year? Because that's what it takes, sometimes more. Of course, that wasn't my case, luckily. And I thought I had an advantage because I took all those creative writing classes in college. And he says, yeah, I went to a lot of writing seminars too, and I never met a writer who didn't introduce himself to me as an author instead of a waiter. Writers, you know, are a lot like actors. We have this inflated sense of importance as we're writing, especially when we finish the damn thing. Anyway, Johnny, here's a few things I found out while writing and trying to sell my book. First thing, there's nothing easy about it. And it's far more insulting and ego-deflating when you send out 101 manuscripts to agents and book publishing firms, and you wait and you wait, weeks turn into months, and you receive absolutely nothing. No answer. It's the silence that's deafening, and you start to feel your writing stinks. You're a hack. You're a loser. Oh, and Johnny, I didn't send 100 manuscripts. I sent 100 packets and or emails with the first 3 chapters and a synopsis. That's what you do. And after a month or 2 or 4 goes by, you naturally think something's wrong with the snail mail or the email, and you resubmit. And then, and only then, is when you finally get a letter. In my case, a couple of letters. All of them form letters of rejection. And for those few literary agents who actually bothered to reply directly to me, as a human, not in a form letter, they'd say things like, 600 pages, that's way too long. You should make a trilogy out of it. Now, if you're over 40 or 50, you remember a lot of books that were pretty hefty like that. War and Peace being the best example, but the feedback I was getting is that no one wants a book over 200 pages anymore. You see, we're in a world of sound bites and decreased attention spans, so that's what it is. And in a way, that makes writing all that much easier. 200 pages versus 600, man, I could kick out a first draft in a month or two. And then there were other agents that actually wrote back to me personally. Don't think they really were agents, probably secretaries to agents. They'd say, to whom is this book written for? Who is your audience? You must understand your audience, you know. This is your first book, and what you need to know is that amateurs write for themselves and for their pleasure, and professional writers write for others. And then I got one letter from a big New York agency, also a rejection, but there were some tips. She said, does this book have a genre? Because, you know, bookstores don't like to be confused. They need to know where to place a book on the shelves in order to sell it, i.e. cookbooks, diet books, martial art books, and celebrity tell-all books. And one editor went as far as telling me to just give up on it, saying that 99 out of 100 first books only sell about 20 copies, including your mother your friends and your ex-spouses. Oh, and about those famous writing workshops you pay $500 to go to on a weekend, always hosted by a B-grade writer who sold 20,000 books in his life, and now he's the expert. Well, I took one of those too, and now I'm out $500 and I feel even worse. So how'd that go, you might ask? You find yourself pretty much in a room full of broke losers who, if they're really lucky, will end up like the presenter giving courses because there's no way to make money writing books unless you know you're Stephen King or R.J. Rowling's. A lot of good and very good authors live a life of broken despair, only to be discovered and appreciated much later. For example, Van Gogh, he didn't sell a single painting his whole life. Yeah, you know, it's been said that death is sometimes the best career move for an author. Well, Johnny, I'm not buying into that because I am coming down to Latin America on my plan B, going to do what I've never been able to do up in the States. You know, scratch an itch that's been bothering me for a long, long time, that itch being writing a book and actually selling a few copies. And not just to my mother, my friends, and my ex-wives either. So in a couple of months, I'll be heading to Guatemala, to the Lake Atitlan region. I've heard a lot of famous authors have written books up there, like Aldous Huxley. Legend has it he wrote Brave New World up there. So with that kind of gravitas hanging over me, if I can't write, as you say, Johnny, the great un-American novel, then I guess I might as well just remain a lush. Oh, and Johnny, when I took one of those book writers courses, they always said, your first book is a practice run, the one you make all your mistakes on, and only 1 in 10,000 first books ever gets published. It's your second book you got a halfway decent shot at. Halfway decent meaning 1 in 1,000. One-armed bandits have better odds than that. But this time, Johnny, I'm playing the game a little bit differently. When I'm done with this book, it's going right up on Amazon. Self-publishing is here. It's the future. It's all the rage. Seems anyone who's written a book or think he has and has got 100 or so bucks, you can have it up on Amazon for the world to see. And they say if you've got a good cover and a good title, that's half of the marketing. Which is why, Johnny, I want to ask you a favor. Would you mind if I borrowed your title, The Great Un-American Novel? That's catchy. It has a lot of hidden meanings in it. Even if the book itself doesn't have much to do with the title, I tell you, Johnny, it's a grabber. Signed, Sir Derek the Lazy. Oh, Derek, don't we all wish we made money the easy way, like you, through inheritance. As they say in Scotland, ya lucky shite. Well, Derek, for one, you're doing the right thing. You're getting out of Dodge. Even if your reason for coming down is a lot different than most other people's. I didn't hear you mention any of the usual suspects. Being on a treadmill, stressed out, pissed off at Big Brother, the IRS, and all the other alphabet agencies, dumbing down schools, the massively expensive healthcare system, banksters and the pharmaceutical fascists, the Federal Reserve. Nope, not a mention of that stuff in your email. But that's all right, we've all got our own reasons for making the move. And I'll tell you, Derek, I'm glad you mentioned Amazon, because I happen to be pretty good friends with an expat gringo here in Latin America. He's been down here a long, long time, and his idea to impress his young son, who's about 13, his son's half gringo and half Latino, he married a Latina, he said, all my life what I really wanted to do was write a book, so when my son goes to school and people ask him what his dad does, he can say he's an author, not a gringo who started from scratch and now has a couple of big factories. And who wouldn't be proud of that? Well, that, he says, is not what he wants his legacy to be. He wants to be known as an author. He wants his kid to understand that and be proud of it. Because all the other kids' parents at the helicopter school he goes to have traditional wealth. Fast food chains, sugar plantations, car dealerships. So in his kids' helicopter school, that kind of wealth is old hat. Now, you might laugh, but man, I'm serious here. My gringo buddies told me many times he wants his son to think that he's a successful author. So by God, he actually did write that book. Took him a couple years. And guess who he gave the galleys to? Yours truly. Yep, he wanted me to be the first reader. And man, the story was phenomenal, but the writing sucked. Hey, what do you expect? First book, right? But like I said, the story was outstanding. But man, I never read a book before that jumped from first to second to third person, all in the first couple pages. Now that's confusing. So anyway, I kind of gave him some pointers. Now I know what you're thinking. What am I doing giving him pointers on writing a book? Let's just say I've had a little experience at it myself. Anyway, he polished it up a bit. The writing sucked a little less, but it still sucked. Though, seriously, the story is amazing. So then after a few rewrites, he said, Johnny, I'm going to put it on Amazon. And I thought, well, good luck with that, being that reading books is a dying art. Anyway, I had to admire the guy. At least he was giving it a shot. So he had a decent title. He did some nice artwork. And then a couple of months went by, and I didn't see him. Next thing you know, I get a phone call. He says, Johnny, you're not going to believe this. I've sold 4,000 books on Amazon. And I'm thinking, really? He doesn't have that many ex-wives. But like I said, great story. In fact, it has Hollywood written all over it. But I doubt anyone in Hollywood reads books either. They're just going to read a screenplay or treatment, right? And even then, you really have to know someone to get it in the right hands. So there's another real-life boots-on-the-ground story direct from Central America, way off the Gringo tourist trail. A success story for a guy who always wanted to write a book just to impress his son. And man, he did it. So don't think your life is over at 55 still running yourself ragged on the treadmill up in Cleveland. Get that plan B going. You can take a shot at all the things you wish you would have done. So bottom line here, there's multiple facets to that email and that story I told about my friend selling 4,000 books on Amazon in just a few months. The fact is, once you've got your plan B underway and you get down here to Latin America, you can do all those things you could never get done up in the States because there just wasn't enough time and because your treadmill was running way too fast. All right, here's another email I promised to get to. And I'll paraphrase as usual, try to speed things up. He says, hey, Johnny, could you give us some info about sanitation in hostels, restaurants, cafes, etc. that you find all over Latin America? For example, places in Central America like Antigua, Atitlan, Chela. He says, I've noticed they use tap water and bleach to wash dishes and utensils, or so I hear. But often they use dirty towels to dry dishes, etc. I hear there's dysentery, diarrhea, parasites, and all kinds of stomach and digestion problems at various places because of this. So I guess, besides carrying your own utensils with you, what can people do to avoid these unpleasant experiences? Also, what natural type of remedies like colloidal silver, etc. do you recommend to heal these conditions? Then he says, I've used Gary Null's bug out extract for some issues and it works great. I think it's the best on the market. Thanks for the great shows. Signed, Ron. All right, Ron, a couple of things here. If you're going to be way off the Gringo tourist trail and you're in a place like Chela, Atitlan, Copan, any place where there's a small town, you'll find lots of small little mom and pop restaurants everywhere and almost no big or medium-sized restaurants or franchises at all, except the usual suspects like McDonald's, Wendy's, and Pizza Hut. Those are ubiquitous. And I'd say in at least half of the mom-and-pop joints, sanitation is not a priority. Though some of them, when you walk in and look around, you say, hell, this place is immaculate, spick and span. So what you notice in the dining area in the way of orderliness, cleanliness, and lighting, or complete lack of, is a good reflection of what's going on behind the scenes. Now, I've been down here a long, long time, more than two decades, and I have to say in the first two or three years, I had my share of Montezuma's revenge, but after that, it pretty much never happened again. In fact, it's been so long I can't even remember the last time I had a date with the porcelain goddess. Because I follow certain rules. Now, when you're off or even way off the Gringo tourist trail, like I said, there'll be a lot of mom and pop restaurants. Dirt cheap, too. And when you're hungry, you gotta eat, right? First thing I do is go into the bathroom. If they've got cloth towels or nothing to wipe your hands with, I'm out of there. They must have disposable paper towels. Then I almost always pop my head into the kitchen. If there's just heaps of stuff everywhere, on the counters, on the floor, flies buzzing around, cucarachas, I'm out of there. And of course, I always drink out of the bottle or a can, and I wipe the bottle or the can off first, and I never, never drink anything with ice cubes in it. Even though Latin waiters and waitresses have the habit of opening up your can or bottle and pouring it right into a glass full of ice, I always stick my hand up in his face and say, wait, let me do that. Just leave it on the table, please. I don't even bother going through the explanation. I don't want ice, and I don't want a glass. Because, you know, it's just not worth it and they don't get it anyway. Now, here's my point. You could call me a clean freak. I have a bottle of colloidal silver sitting right here in my studio on the desk. And I only really use it when I think I'm coming down with a cold or a sore throat, a couple of sprays in the throat three times a day, and it's usually dead in its tracks and never becomes full-blown. But I'm not so concerned or obsessed as to bring my colloidal silver bottle around with me to restaurants and such, like some people up in the States do. In fact, I know some people up there who bring napkins with them and they wipe down the seats and put their own napkins or towels on the armrests. They just don't want to come in contact with anyone else's germs. Hey, I don't either, but I'm not obsessed about it. Though I do think it's a good idea to have one of those little ionizers that hang from your neck. They're designed to be worn on an airplane. Gary Null sells those things too. Because you know the air in an airplane is continuously recycled, so you're breathing in everyone else's as well. Joims. And I don't know about you, but every time I get off of a long flight, I feel kind of shot for a couple of hours. Now, when you're in these mom-and-pop restaurants, and they're everywhere, and there's no OSHA or FDA, so it is buyer beware, and people say, what? No OSHA? No FDA? Well, just remember the FDA puts its stamp of approval on poisonous food not fit for pets. In fact, the FDA has a seal on products that make us less healthy. So the FDA, like all the other alphabet agencies, are just a big frickin' joke. Anyway, when you go into any Latin restaurant, you'll notice a nicely framed government sanitation certificate. Yep, every little business on the books has to get one of those things before they open their doors. But that doesn't mean a thing. Even though the English translation is sanitation certificate, don't think it actually stands for anything. Which leads us directly to backpackers. They're everywhere, too, sleeping on $5 a night, bug-infested mattresses that never get cleaned, 12 people using a single bathroom. And really, I've yet to see a backpacker hostel that had paper disposable towels in any bathroom. Though I've seen plenty of perpetually moist cloth towels. Yuck. So here in Latin America and throughout the world, you've got a whole genre of cheapskates known as backpackers in English. In Spanish, mochileros or backpackers. Yep, and they're going to the cheapest bars, cheapest restaurants, cheapest hostels, and they tip worse than I do. That's a joke. When you remember me talking about Chinese restaurants down here, they're everywhere, and they're also some of the cheapest restaurants in Latin America. So when you're kind of close to the tourist trail or around where backpackers hang, the Chinese restaurants are filled with backpackers. And man, I'll tell you, down here in Latin America, there's nothing more unsanitary than a Chinese restaurant, really. Just have a look in the kitchen. Have a look in the bathroom. On second thought, don't have a look in the bathroom. But you know, you can always find it, even in a blackout. Just follow your nose. Oh, but they give huge portions, all right. And the backpackers love that because then they can split a dish between three people. And you know, I never met up with a bunch of backpackers yet, or at least one of them wasn't nursing a hangover or multiple bug bites, sunburn, Montezuma's Revenge, or all of the above. Now, if you think some of the restaurant bathrooms are bad, you ought to go into a communal bathroom at a backpacker hostel. On second thought, don't go in. Just stand about 20 feet away and have a look at the grunge around the doorknob. So how's your appetite? Oh, by the way, I was talking to a New York gringo the other day. Just flew in to come to my expat insider seminar. He was telling me about the last restaurant he ate at in Manhattan. Pretty high class joint, he said. And when he was going to the restroom, he saw a big ass rat slinking under the kitchen door. Looked a lot like Hillary. And that's in New York at a high class restaurant. So what do you make of that? All I can tell you is this. I, and many of my long-term gringo friends, almost never suffer from Montezuma's Revenge. Oh, and remember, one of the filthiest items in a restaurant or house is the bathroom doorknob and or handle, which is why I always use a piece of paper or a Kleenex to open the bathroom door when I'm leaving. I mean, when you're entering, who gives a rip? Because you're going to wash your hands on the way out, right? That's the problem, you see. You wash your hands on the way out and you got to touch the knob, right? Well, that kind of negates everything, doesn't it? So do yourself a favor. Even though most modern restrooms and hotels and such don't have towels anymore, they got those also quite unsanitary hand dryers because they're just blowing around all that hand bacteria and what's wafting up from the toilets too, you know. In fact, they're warming it up and bacteria love it. That's how they breed. The higher the temperature, the more active they are. But there's nothing you can do about that, except don't breathe much and get in and out in a hurry. My advice, take a Kleenex napkin or piece of paper and open the door on the way out with it. So what do you do with the paper? Well, just leave it on the knob or the handle. It'll stick there. Which is why I always, wherever I go, in my right front pocket, carry a couple of napkins. Just for those bathroom doorknob eventualities. Call me picky, call me fastidious, call me a German, I've been called worse, but don't call me unsanitary. Oh, and on that front, it's not a good thing to shake hands with people either. Even though it's a tradition that's gone through millennia, showing that the person you're greeting doesn't have a weapon in his hand. The fact is, it's infinitely more sanitary to just bump fists with a person. You know, close fists. Doop. Guys don't mind, and women, well, down here it's all hugs and cheek kisses anyway, so you'll rarely have a chance to shake hands with a woman. By the way, the fist bump's about the only positive thing the rap and hip-hop culture has given the world, you know. Now, as far as the utensils themselves, the plates, the forks and knives, I always, and this is my pattern, take the forks, knives, spoons, whatever I'm going to use, and wipe them down with a napkin, as inconspicuously as possible, of course. And I take a good look at the plates and saucers and cups that are already on the table, and if they look a little munged up and grungy, I'm not beyond telling the waiter or waitress to get me a fresh set of really clean ones. But I'll tell you, percentage-wise, there are just as many people getting sick on the gringo tourist trail as off. So don't think just because the gringos have arrived in a big way that's somehow improved general food preparation hygiene techniques. Again, it's buyer beware, and I like that. Who needs the nanny state? I mean, look, if in New York where they've got tons of lard-ass government inspectors, yet rats can roam the kitchens of upscale restaurants, what's the point? So when I'm doing an offering as tips to you guys and gals out there, surely works. And I don't obsess about it, though Captain Mango's called me on it a few times. He thinks I go overboard. Though he rarely gets sick, he uses a slightly different method. He claims tequila's the universal antibacterial agent. But there is another pathway to sickness down here, too. A lot of gringos end up getting sick after they've attended a quinceañeros party, after a dinner invite from middle-class neighbors, or backyard barbecue. So when you get invited to those things, and you will if you're off the gringo tourist trail, look out for those mayonnaise dishes that have been left out all day. And of course, be on the lookout for flies. And the fact is, when I see flies, I don't eat. And you have to remember, almost all houses in Latin America do not have screens, and they open the windows all the time to get breezes. Flies and people in homes are commingling all the time. But I'll have you know, not where I live. When I hear buzzing, man, I'm on it. Yep, I've gone through lots of fly swatters. And now we've got an inquiry from a permanent resident, gringo, Altiplano Drifter. He also happens to be a repeat offender at my Expat Insider Seminar. He's been asking about how to ship silver into Latin America from the States or from a silver or bullion dealer. And I always say, if you've got silver up in the States and you want to send it down, sell it up there, take the cash, come on down, buy your silver down here, because you can buy it at some of the jewelry fabricators in the medium and large cities and those numismatic outfits that buy and sell and trade coins and stamps. Because I'll tell you right now, it's a losing proposition to send silver from the States down here to Latin America, because you'll spend a lot of money because it weighs a lot and it's difficult to get the stuff insured. Not to mention, being it's the third world, it's sort of unpredictable what's going to happen in customs. So it's a flip of the coin whether it's going to be a smooth or difficult process. Like I said, sell what you got, bring the cash down, buy it down here. And as for gold, buy it in the States and walk it on through. You don't want to do large amounts. Bring in, you know, 5 to 7 1-ounce coins at a time. Keep it under the $10,000 limit, even though, since the U.S. and Canadian 1-ounce coins have $50 stamped right on them, you got a good argument that you could probably bring in around 200 of them, because according to the stamp right on the coin, that's only $10,000 in face value, the limit. But there's no telling what U.S. Customs and the Border Patrol idiots are going to do, so just bring 6 or 7 of them in every time you fly and you'll be fine. In fact, good old John Galt used to mix a couple of gold coins, never ounces, like half ounces, quarter ounces, in with his regular change, along with a couple of pesos, colones, doubloons, whatever. And when he'd pass through the scanners, he'd just throw it in a little tray and no one was the wiser. The stuff, as long as it's not super shiny, and there are ways to dull it up pretty good, will blend in nicely with any coins. Especially many Latin American coins and euros, because a lot of them are fake brass and gold colored. Not a bad trick, huh? And finally, you know, you heard me speak a lot about shipping things here to Latin America, and you've heard me talk about the forwarding services you can use, most of them located in Miami. You can have Amazon, eBay, or anyone send your stuff to that address, and it'll get forwarded right down to your Latin country. Or I should say in Central America, because in South America, it's a different game altogether. Not only are the shipping distances extreme, there's a lot of chaos going on. Of course, it's got to do with the slug asses in government. So again, it's pretty straightforward and easy when you're in Central America. But South America, well, I want you to listen to this article that just came out. Ever since International Living has been touting Ecuador, the gringos have been piling in like crazy. And isn't it funny how Nicaragua was on International Living's top 10 list for many years, too? Hate to say I told you so, but let's shift to International Living's favorite place, Ecuador. Listen to this. Here's an article that came out just last week, titled, Duty-Free Shipping for Legal Residents in Ecuador is Restored, but Shippers are Warning of Many Problems Ahead. It says, reversing a rule issued in May, the government says that new expats can once again ship their household belongings to Ecuador duty-free. Then it says the allowance for expats had been discontinued on May 15 as a result of a presidential decree that expanded the list of items that Ecuadorian citizens returning from overseas can bring into the country. Sounds good, right? But here's the problem. The word of the policy change to duty-free shipping has apparently not reached the customs offices. As of Thursday night, according to two expats whose containers are being held at the port, quote, the aduana customs agent says he knows nothing about any changes and will not release the shipment unless we pay. Alex Spendler, who moved to Cuenca last month, says they're charging me $100 a day for storage of my container and it's just killing me. That means if it stays a month, that's over $3,000 just in storage fee, not customs or taxes. In a similar story, expat John Hansel says, My facilitator is working to getting my stuff released, but she has no idea when it'll happen. It's great, he says, that they're bringing back duty-free shipping, but I'm still being gouged to death with expenses. Then it says, despite the reinstatement of the duty-free rule, two of the biggest shippers there say the customs situation in Ecuador is becoming increasingly more difficult, and expats should consider not shipping anything at all. All right, me, Johnny here, that's quite an astounding statement. Remember, these are shippers who depend on shipping containers from gringos and such to make a living, and they're telling gringos now, don't do it. But it gets worse. It says, the customs process in Guayaquil has become a bigger mess every year in the 8 years since we've been arranging shipments, says Florida shipper Stephen Aaron. Unless changes are made in the scheduling and procedure of what he calls the draconian container examinations, expats will continue to pay huge and exorbitant fees. But that's not all. San Diego, California shipper Kurt Ellis agrees and says that those moving to Ecuador should carefully consider their options before deciding to ship any containers or air pallets at all. He says, I'm in the shipping business, so I have nothing to gain by telling people not to ship, but if I was moving to Ecuador, I wouldn't do it. People are routinely paying hundreds, even thousands of dollars just for the storage fees on their containers as they sit in port. And to charge that is perfectly legal, though grossly unfair. And there's a big problem later on with theft as your container is left, often for weeks and months at a time, unattended. And then he says, shipping pallets and containers anywhere in Latin America has always been kind of a pain in the ass, but it's much, much worse in Ecuador than any place else. Yet another expat living in Ecuador caught in the shipping loop says, you know, I love Ecuador and the people, but theft is a way of life. So expats need to be alert and aware. Now here's the topper. He says, I would even consider not coming to Ecuador at all. The government has become increasingly hostile toward foreigners. Consider the way they discriminate against foreigners for health insurance now. Then it says, don't just think this applies to containers. We had a simple medium FedEx box held up in Guayaquil Customs for over a month. They were demanding a more thorough description of the product from Amazon. Why couldn't they have looked it up themselves? Because it's in English, of course. The end result, we were charged an additional $80 just for the storage while we waited. Yep, there are serious problems in customs here in Ecuador.
You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!